WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's time for our weekly news recap, where we catch you up on the biggest state and local stories that you might have missed but need to know about. Stories like these.
4 people were shot and killed on a Blue Line train.
An Illinois law banning people with concealed carry permits from taking guns on public transportation is unconstitutional.
Questions are circulating about how the Chicago Transit Authority is handling its duty to reassure riders that they're safe.
The man at the center of it is longtime CTA president Dorval Carter.
The CTA announced the rollout of software designed to detect guns on the L.
But the tech is not without its critics.
Our panel this week to help break down the top stories are Paris Schutz, political correspondent for Fox 32, Tom Shuba, reporter and editor for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Manny Ramos, an investigative reporter for Block Club Chicago. We began the conversation with the horrific shooting on the Blue Line, and I started by asking Tom how they found the alleged shooter so quickly.
Yeah, so CTA has this massive network of cameras, and there's cameras on trains, and so what prosecutors and officials have said is that Forest Park Police worked with the CTA. They tracked this person using cameras to the California Pink Line station. CPD officers made an arrest. Forest Park came and picked the person up.
Yeah.
So it all happened in a matter of, I think, about an hour and a half.
And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, the video shows him just walking off the train after having shot and killed people.
Yes.
Wow. What else do we know about 30-year-old Ronnie Davis?
Well, Ronnie Davis has a background of arrests, gun arrests, issues paying rent recently, kind of a tangled web of court files. There was some different names used, some different genders used. There was a name change over a decade ago, an effort, I think, last year to change the name back that it wasn't completed.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, more questions than answers.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, so the alleged shooter is facing 4 counts of murder, right? And the judge ordered that he stay in jail. Now, did the hearing shed any light at all on his motivations here?
No. I mean, they kind of went through that TikTok that I went through with you of kind of what happened. But the day before, State's Attorney Kim Fox had already said, we might never know, you know, what the motivation for this shooting was. And we certainly don't know that at this point still.
Now, the tragedy has brought the CTA under additional scrutiny, and CTA President Dorval Carter held a rare press conference in Forest Park the day after. Here's a little part of what he said.
You're talking about a system that has 145 rail stations, 1,500 rail cars, 1,800 buses, covers almost 240 miles of track, over 1,500 miles of bus routes, over 10,000 bus stops. It is huge. And we obviously are focused on how to address that as best as possible.
So, Paris, was Dorval Carter able to calm concerns about safety at that press conference?
I don't think so. I think if you use the CTA regularly and you listen to that, and then what happened afterward, there was a stabbing near the Red Line that same night.
Mm-hmm.
So those words felt hollow. But yeah, and when you're trying to say you know, look, things happen. This system is huge.
Yeah.
We can't prevent all crime. You know, I looked into what their security apparatus is. It's $62 million budget just for security. It's cameras on every train and every bus and every station. It's 300 security guards that are plainclothes. They'll hop on a train, hop off. And then there's a dedicated CPD unit, you know, that are roaming around. I don't know how big that is, but clearly they can't prevent something like this. The other issue is homelessness. Now, we don't know for sure whether these four folks were homeless, but they were sleeping on the train. And that has been a problem in the CTA forever, obviously. Yeah. And not just because of what it means for other riders, but their own vulnerability to something like this. So when you put all those ingredients in, you can invest all the money you want in any camera technology and security guards, and something's going to happen at 4 a.m.
Manny, you have done a lot of reporting about the CTA. So, I mean, talk more about that. How big of a concern do activists and riders say to you that security is?
Security has been a top concern for the CTA since the pandemic, really. I mean, it's really come to the forefront when we saw a spike in crime really elevate itself in those early years. You know, and CTA has come out in recent years and showcased that crime is down. But as Parrish just mentioned, there's been a recent string of high-profile violent crimes that have happened after this Blue Line shooting. Mm-hmm. We also had a Red Line shooting that involved a CTA employee.
And I think another Blue Line shooting last night outside of the Logan Square station.
Yeah, Milwaukee Avenue was a drive-by. It looked like the guy was just waiting for a bus or whatever the case may be. So we don't know the full details about that. But crime is definitely front and center when we talk about, you know, riders who depend on this. We look at activist groups such as Commuters Take Action, who've issued out a release, really calling on leadership to step this up and protect its riders.
You just finished up an in-depth look at what Dorval Carter's been up to, because we know he's been under a lot of criticism himself lately. So what did you find out?
So we requested documents that involve Dorval Carter's public schedule. We really wanted to see what he was doing day to day, how often he was visiting train stations and bus terminals. And what we found actually is Carter spends a great deal amount of his time traveling. When we looked at about 345 days within, you know, the past year, we found that he was out of the state or out of Chicago about 97 days. So we're talking about nearly a third of his time outside of Chicago. And if you contrast that with how many times he's actually visiting stations or bus terminals, it pales in comparison. We're talking about only 9 times within those 345 days.
Interesting. So sticking with this topic of safety, Tom, the transit agency recently began a pilot program where they're using AI technology to detect guns. Walk us through that.
Yeah, so last week the CTA came out and they said, okay, well, we're doing this one-year pilot program that started about a month ago, costing taxpayers $200,000 from the CTA's large security budget. And essentially, it's like artificial intelligence that uses camera technology to spot guns. We don't know how, you know, tested this has been. Yeah. They've been getting contracts. The company has been lobbying pretty hard. They've getting contracts with schools specifically. But there isn't really a lot of evidence to show that this is like an effective thing. And we have had this battle brewing for a long time over ShotSpotter, which is a gunshot detection instead of a gun detection program using AI. So
And Dorval Carter was asked about that at the press conference. Hey, like, you did this PR rollout of this new technology. What gives? Obviously, Ronnie had to come on to a CTA station to get on the train with a gun. These cameras are supposed to detect a gun.
Yeah.
Now, they won't say where these cameras, where this AI technology is deployed. So it's deployed. There's, what, something like 250 of them?
It's called Zero Eyes.
Zero
right?
Eyes, yeah. The inference is it wasn't at the, you know, the Harlem Blue Line or the Forest Park Blue Line stop. Because they won't say where they are. The other thing is, you know, I spoke to some aldermen that said, like, we didn't even know they were doing this.
Really?
Like you would think that, you know, a program like this, you know, you'd have to go to city council or at least like have a debate about it, or whether this is effective, whether this is an effective use of money. And he said, it's just a pilot. It just got up and running. It's not been around long enough for us to really adequately measure whether it's effective or not. And it's just $200,000. And as Tom mentioned, yeah, it smells of like a company trying to push this technology to get a contract and Carter and the CTA biting on it. But when you look at like just the sheer range of violence we've talked about this week, how do you justify giving a multimillion-dollar contract to this technology when We had the worst mass shooting in my recent memory on the CTA.
And there's also significant limitations to what the technology does. It can't detect anything that's concealed. So if you have it in your pocket and in a bag, it's not going to find it. So you actually have to physically brandish the weapon before it even is detected. And that leaves a lot of speculation of, like, what happens when you walk into that train car and you pull a gun. These cameras aren't in the train cars at the moment. What is the purpose of it? What purpose is it serving for someone to just walk around with a gun, showcasing it before police are called?
Yes, CTA released a video showing an officer like walking down a train platform holding a long gun. And it's like, well, why wouldn't someone just pick up the phone and call the police?
Right.
And, you know, I guess
you don't need a camera to detect that. Like,
or their normal surveillance camera will be able to see that.
Right.
You know?
The ACLU is raising privacy concerns too.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest issue I think that the ACLU raised was that there was no public notice or opportunity for public comment, kind of what Paris was talking about. Like, this has been a very loaded conversation about AI-based surveillance technology in Chicago. And CTA kind of just, like, slid in here as the ShotSpotter contract is ending and implemented this thing without any notice to Alders, to the public, and we don't really know how this thing works or if it will work. So,
and there are quite a few other surveillance tools being used to ensure rider safety. So, I mean, we've got tens of thousands of surveillance cameras, right? Those are supposed to be installed in every station and on every train car.
Every station, every train car, every bus. But can I also bring up, you know, Dorval Carter? You talked about how he's, you know, Manny did that great report about how he's spending more time, you know, traveling, and he doesn't answer questions from the press very often. It's almost like they had to drag him to this press conference. I mean, four people, mass shooting on the CTA, you got to be there and talk about it. So a day later, yes, he did answer questions, but it's pretty amazing. In the Johnson administration, a lot of agency heads that were there under Lightfoot lost their jobs, like Allison Arwadi in health. And Dorval Carter's been the most sort of criticized, and yet somehow he holds on to his job. And this is the highest salary, $360,000 or $370,000. There's older people like Andre Vasquez that want him fired because there's obviously been the reliability issues, which he blames, which Carter blames on staffing and getting the staffing back. But it's hard to have confidence in his leadership. Not only when this look, you can't prevent a tragedy, but when you don't get the sense that there's a steady hand at the top of it, I really never got a great answer from the mayor on why they haven't looked at making a change at the CTA. It's just such an important part of the city.
The mayor's office won't even say why they're keeping him.
Yeah.
Right? They're completely silent. Anytime
just complete silence on
the
entire topic.
Questions, they decline to answer. They just completely seems to be washing their hands of the situation.
Well, in addition to these tens of thousands of surveillance cameras, they've got 300 security guards patrolling the system, a dedicated Chicago police unit that's assigned to patrol trains and buses 24/7. I want to go back to an issue that we sort of brushed over earlier, right? This is the growing number of unhoused people that are riding the CTA here in the city. Three of the folks killed, as we mentioned, were sleeping. I mean, Manny, do you think that going forward, we're going to, you know, be paying more attention to this issue? I mean, after what just happened?
Yeah, this is an issue we all should have been paying attention to for quite some time, and we have. And, you know, CTA says that they're working with, you know, organizations like the Knight Ministry to sort of find housing and find social services for folks who are desperately in need. But to rely solely on the CTA to solve this issue, I think, is unfair. I mean, we can criticize the CTA for a lot of things. Asking them to fix the housing situation in our city, I think, is a little too much.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it involves a coalition of groups as well as, you know, full strings from the mayor's office to really tackle this problem.
Absolutely. The city council is weighing in on this shooting as well. Here is Southside Alderman David Moore of the 17th Ward. He says it highlights the need for more mental health services.
Dorval Carter, from a security standpoint and everything that he's trying to do, he's doing it. We still short police. That's the bottom line. We have to make sure people are getting access to mental health care because it's serious and it's real.
Paris, do you think that the city's political leaders are going to be increasing calls?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this event this week has certainly given them an opportunity to more people are starting to talk about it. And in terms of the, you know, the unhoused situation, Dorval Carter defended it, saying we are doing more under my leadership than we've ever done in the CTA. That's, I mean, that's his characterization of it. That, as Manny said, getting the night ministry to come and help people. And he did say, like, look, this is, we, the CTA can't solve homelessness. This is just not what we do. And it needs to take, you know, a whole of government approach to deal with this. But there's clearly been a problem of folks sleeping on the train. And like we mentioned before, it's making them vulnerable now. You know, at 3 a.m., 4 a.m., if you're asleep, you know, God knows what's going to happen, you know.
Well, before we take a quick break, Tom, it's notable that just days before this shooting, a judge ruled unconstitutional an Illinois law that was banning concealed guns on public transit. So what are the details?
This was a federal judge in Rockford, and I think essentially there was a group of people who wanted to carry their weapons on transit, which is illegal under state law, and judge struck this down pursuant to this kind of watershed recent Supreme Court ruling, Bruin, which essentially said, as the Supreme Court takes on gun issues, we have to hearken back to 1700s when the Bill of Rights was written. Mm-hmm. And at that point, there were no restrictions on carrying your gun publicly. And so the AG, Kwame Rule, has vowed to appeal this ruling. As it stands now, this is not some overarching decision. It only applies to the people who were involved in the lawsuit.
So this judge's ruling says concealed guns should be allowed on public transit?
Yes.
Earlier this week, Tom covered the abrupt firing of two high-ranking officials with the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, the agency charged with investigating police misconduct. Yesterday, he wrote about staffers calling for the removal of the head of that agency. So I asked Tom to walk us through that story.
This has kind of been unfolding for months, where COPA employees have been making complaints about bias and about operations and how investigations are handled. One of the big early flashpoints that we were made aware of, that we got a letter that was sent to the IG and to the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability. We'll call it the commission moving forward. A group of employees wrote a letter about this investigation into a migrant sex abuse scandal, which wound up to be unfounded claims, but COPA had to handle this investigation. And there were concerns about how that was handled. So fast forward, these complaints have kept coming in to the CCPSA. The CCPSA has taken these complaints. They've referred them to the IG to investigate. The IG has said we are reviewing them. Fast forward to last Friday, we had the dismissal of two high-ranking COPA employees. A letter we obtained that was written on Monday by this group of 16 current and former COPA employees essentially said these were whistleblowers. They were talking to the CCPSA. They were talking to the IG. And in that letter, these current and former employees said, we want you, the CCPSA, the commission, to act and to take a no confidence vote in Andrea Kirsten, the chief of COPA, which would be the first step in removing her.
What is the process for ousting the head of COPA?
It starts with, a no confidence vote and then a measure to that end. And then it's referred to the Police and Fire Committee of the City Council and then to the full council.
What does Andrea Kirsten have to say about this?
COPA has stood by its work. They say they are committed to police accountability. I believe they feel a bit backed into the corner. They are facing a lawsuit from the FOP, also claiming bias and issues with investigations. So at the same time, you've had the superintendent of police, Larry Snelling, go after Kirsten publicly for her handling of the Dexter Reed investigation, the shooting of the young man on the west side by police.
That was this past March, right?
Yes. And so I think the agency is imperiled, but Kirsten is imperiled at this moment. And it is difficult to really suss out, you know, the merits of these complaints. And there has, you know, it seems like it's mounting, but we'll have to see how it plays out with the IG.
Generous, I know you want to get in here.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting about this is COPPA in its various iterations over the years, it used to be called IPRA, and before that it was called something else. It was known for not taking action against police. I mean, its bias was pro-police. It was pretty much where police misconduct investigations went to die.
And now it's being accused of anti-police bias.
And now the pendulum has swung the complete other direction. And, you know, the agency changed after the Laquan McDonald shooting, and Rahm Emanuel basically ripped up the old agency and put together this new agency. And now you see these complaints. But then it also brings up the whole confusion of police oversight. There's so many different apparatuses, and it's hard to suss out who does what. So COPPA does investigate misconduct, especially, you know, police-involved shootings. Then they make their recommendation to the police board, and then and the superintendent can make his recommendation. But then you've also got as the commission, as Tom called it. Mm-hmm. That's brand new. You've got the police board, which their job is to adjudicate police misconduct and determine whether cops should be dismissed. And you've got the IG that also has a role in investigating police. And you've got internal affairs of the police department, which also has a role in investigating the police. It's such a jumbled mess. And it all was born out of the fact that there was misconduct that was going uninvestigated, obviously. And it's almost like too much of a good thing is a bad thing, because there needs to be some kind of streamlined process in terms of investigative authority, mm-hmm. and then firing authority. And right now, so you've got all these investigative agencies like COPPA, but then you can't really fire a police officer until, because the FOP gets involved, and then they go before the police board, and it becomes like a legal tangle.
Yeah.
And if they don't like what the police board did, then they go to court. So
oh my goodness.
It's so confusing. It's so confusing.
I do think this is going to be, you know, these layers of oversight that we've lumped on, right? Not to mention, he didn't mention the police district councils, which
the police district councils,
also that. Yeah. But now we have these two kind of tracks happening with COPPA right now. We have this referral to the IG, which was made by the commission, which the IG has only said, we are reviewing what you have, and that we've obtained that letter. But then you have the commission continuing to go forward. Today, they're having a closed-door meeting with the people who wrote this letter that have been pushing them to move forward with the process to fire Kirsten. So this is going to be a test of this, right? The IG is historically slow, right? And sometimes the IG can be referred things and they go and they get deep sixed, you know? They go into the black hole. Or maybe 3 years later, you're reading a quarterly report of the IG and you go, that sounds vaguely familiar, but it has no names and the findings will be limited or there will be a reprimand or something. So, you know, we have these two tracks and it's kind crazy, of like going to square itself away, I guess.
Unless I'm mistaken, there's crazy rule that the IG can't release these reports and details unless they get the approval of like the agency, which is crazy. So the police department has to sign off before the IG can release a report like that.
Oh boy. Well, let's turn now to, because there's more on this beat. I want to turn to a former assistant state's attorney in charge of investigating wrongful convictions who is suing Kim Fox. Tell me what you know about this one, Tom.
This is Nancy Aducci, and I can't think of the name of the wrongful conviction unit. They've changed it. But this is Fox's baby, right? We don't know what Fox's next move is, but, you know, if she continues a political career, certainly she will lean into the work of this agency and, you know, the exonerations of people and reviewing convictions. So Aducci headed this unit, I believe, and she got in some hot water over a case involving the killing of a Chicago police officer, Clifton Lewis. And there were allegations that essentially evidence was suppressed and she was demoted. She left the office and she's ultimately filed this report and she's claiming that she was, these actions were based on discriminatory reasons.
Her age and her race. So she filed the lawsuit last month. She's accusing Fox of demoting and firing her due to her age and race. She says that she was told last year when she was demoted that they want someone, quote, more representative of the community for the role. Your thoughts, Paris, on just whether she has valid claims here.
It's really tough. I mean, you know, as Tom mentioned, this unit is her baby. When the new executive comes in, they kind of have leeway to hire who they want and to demote who they want and to fire who they want. And if it's based on identity, maybe there's a problem there. But clearly, I think in a legal case, there's enough evidence to suggest that it was based on performance. And not just ideas. So Aducci clearly, has this piece of evidence saying representative of the community. I mean, it seems too vague to build a case around. I do know, there are prosecutors in the office that are unhappy with Fox's marshalling of that office. They want to be more aggressive, and they're going to get a new, more aggressive prosecutor, whether Fioretti wins, he's the Republican running, or Eileen O'Neill Burke. I mean, she's a Democrat who was promised to. So that office is going to change. Yeah. I mean, the focus is going to go back to being, a prosecutorial office where they're tough on crime. We've all been in a situation where a boss comes in, a new management comes in, and they demote this person, they promote that person. They kind of have their free reign to do that. So I think it's a tough legal case.
And there was certainly a cloud, right? There was a series of news stories about the handling of the Clifton Lewis case from Sun-Times Tribune. There was kind of a drip there. So. Yeah. There are questions about the handling of that case.
Tom, two Chicago cops, including a high-ranking official, have been charged in the tire-slashing incident.
Yeah, so the high-ranking official is Deputy Chief Nieves, who was actually demoted. Both cops have had their, police powers stripped. This purportedly happened at the Puerto Rican Festival in June during that in Humboldt Park. And apparently this deputy chief was in uniform. He was caught on camera doing this.
Really?
We don't really have full circumstances. The police essentially put out a release. Obviously, when these sorts of things happen and you're a police reporter, you start getting a million text messages. People say, deputy chief is arrested at the first district, this, that, and the third. And then you're getting 5 million stories of what happened. So you have to go to the police and say, well, what happened? And essentially what they put out was like, they were charged with misdemeanors and it happened on this date. And that's it. So we still are not entirely sure of the circumstances of what led up to slashing this vehicle's tires.
Sounds pretty extreme.
Yeah.
All right, Manny, on the South Side, immigration advocates are worried that false claims about violent migrants are causing xenophobia. What is this about?
Yeah, so there was this claim that went viral online, as particularly in social media such as TikTok and Twitter, and was amplified by billionaire Elon Musk, essentially claiming that a Southside building in Washington Park was invaded, I guess, or overran, taken over, I guess is the word they use, by Venezuelan migrants, folks who are moving into that building complex. And the claim was that essentially they overran the courtyard with guns. It was a motorcycle gang apparently as well. And they're pretty much just taking it over. Police quickly went to the building and found that none of this was true.
None of this was true.
And it was just speculation. And
I saw a video of some neighboring residents also saying that's not true at all. I live here. That's not happening.
Yeah. And a Tribune reporter, Armando Sanchez, I believe, recorded a video with a nearby resident who basically said these are just people trying to survive. They go to work, they come home, they go to school. Mm-hmm. No one's taken over anything. And this, I think, is a recent string of, false information that's been floating around about the current status of Venezuelan migrants across the country.
And how many followers does Elon Musk have on X to be amplifying something like this? Too many.
He very clearly wants to use that platform to elect Donald Trump. And how to do that? Retweet divisive stuff. It's amazing to me that the richest guy in the world, or one of the richest guy that owns this amazingly powerful social media company, can just tweet such nonsense, unsubstantiated nonsense. There was an AI-generated image of Kamala Harris in a communist, in communist garb. He's like, look at this. This is not even subtle propaganda. I mean, it's just right. And so to
and that
retweeting
wasn't the
stuff
first
like
time
this
either.
Is, that's in his interest.
It's dangerous.
And it's the algorithm is such a way that, like you said, he has the most followers on the platform. It's like a fire hose of this. And honestly, as a journalist, Twitter, as it used to be called, was a great utility, right? And things came into your feed, and it was really a spectacular way to monitor breaking news. And now it's like bot city, and you're like, how is this? Yeah. How am I even getting this?
And that's
right
why
now?
I'm barely on there.
And we're going to get into the Russian disinformation charges, yeah. right? I mean, we haven't even talked about that.
We haven't gotten there yet. All right. It's been a tragic week for two Chicago natives, Rachel Goldberg and Jonathan Polin. At the Democratic National Convention, delegates chanted, "Bring them home," as they spoke about their 23-year-old son, Hirsch, who had been held hostage in Gaza. That tragically, he was one of six Israeli hostages whose bodies were recovered last weekend. In several Chicago area synagogues, they held vigils, and they're, of course, mourning his tragic death. So as the world, you know, tries to make sense of things like this, this conflict is raging on. And sometimes that conflict is actually felt here at home, Manny. The uptown neighborhood on the city's north side, they're actually rallying around a Palestinian business right now that was vandalized on Monday morning. What happened?
Yeah, so early Monday morning, a recently opened business in uptown Nabella Cafe found that their windows were smashed simply for displaying a Palestinian flag. The owner, which the cafe is named after a village his family is from, has been, you know, outspoken and proud of his culture and his heritage. And the cafe features a lot of culturally relevant, things that are meaningful for him. He claims that the attack was, you know, racially motivated, and if everything pans out to be true, I mean, it's quite obvious it was. But luckily, though, he has the support of the community. They went there, helped him clean up. They helped him board it up with plywood.
Yep.
And they also decorated the plywood with painting that's really significant to his culture, which is really, really beautiful.
And he raised some money through GoFundMe.
Yeah, he was trying to aim about for $2,500. They've exceeded that and raised about, as of Thursday or Friday morning, about $10,500. Any of those proceedings, he said, are going to go to a group that can help distribute aid for Palestinians.
And I know you didn't actually cover this for Block Club, Manny, but I mean, have you heard whether they've arrested anyone for this vandalism?
As of this morning, I haven't heard anything, no. Yeah.
Let's turn to something very different. Paris alluded to this. The Justice Department says a Chicago high school dropout turned alt-right podcaster has been part of a covert propaganda campaign that's funded by Russia. What, Tom?
Tim Pool. If you're on Twitter, you definitely know him.
Because he's never popping up in your feed. Until now.
Really?
Well,
I must have seen him and just ignored it.
Yeah, he was a Vice reporter back in the day. He's from Chicago. He wears a beanie hat everywhere he goes, including formal occasions. He had this disastrous interview with Ye, the artist formerly known as Kanye West, when Ye was having his anti-Semitic meltdown, where Ye came to Tim Pool's studio with Milo Yiannopoulos and quickly stormed out on Tim Pool.
And I think Nick Fuentes was there too, another Chicago area far right person.
And so Tim Pool is this interesting figure. There was just a Washington Post story about how he bought this skate park in West Virginia and the skate community like revolted against him. But essentially he was a partner, or he was aligned with this Tennessee company, Tenet Media, that, you know, a lot of right wing pundit streamer broadcaster people were involved with. And the Justice Department indicted two people aligned with RT, Russia Today, a Russian state run television company that was sanctioned in the Western world, their business was depleted after the invasion of Ukraine. So what the DOJ alleges is that they created this campaign, among others, that tried to get their messaging across, outside the bounds of any sanctions or anything. And so Tim Pool is apparently identified as commentator two in this indictment. And, essentially, he was apparently taking money Russian money to broadcast with Tenet Media. He has denied this.
$100,000 an episode.
And yes. I think some guy named Benny Johnson is another one of them. Yeah. And they deny, they say they're victims. They didn't know that the Russians were supporting this company. I just find that so hard to believe. I mean, I don't know for a fact, but I find it so hard to believe that they don't know where this money's coming from. And if you... I try not to look at this, but I guess you have to. The dreck that they put out there is basically Russian talking points. It's exactly what Russian disinformation operators want out there in the American bloodstream. And the reason is to divide this country, to weaken the country. And if you're knowingly taking money for this reason, how much do you hate your country, honestly?
Well, you know? Got to take a quick pause, but briefly, while you've got the mic there, Paris, we've got Election Day coming up in 59 days. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's out. He's busy doing his part. Helping Democrats. Where was he last weekend?
He was in New Hampshire. He popped up on cable news on Labor Day. It's like, oh, he must be on vacation. He must have a vacation home out there in Lake Winnipesaukee or something like that.
He was with Kamala Harris.
No, he's working. He was working. It was an AFL-CIO event. And it shows that New Hampshire is a swing state. It's not really a swing state, but I guess it's close enough there that they need a surrogate there. It also shows that Pritzker... it's pretty amazing how he's made himself a national political figure in the Democratic Party. I don't recall an Illinois governor of any party being so nationally prominent. So they certainly view him as helping the ticket and going out there and campaigning for them. Does that mean he has a role in a potential future Harris administration? I don't know. I don't know that he would want one. He's governor of Illinois. Is he going to run for governor again? I don't know. But he's splitting his time running the state of Illinois, which has a lot of problems and a lot of stuff to do, and trying to help out the Harris Walls ticket.
To wrap the recap, we moved into discussing this week in sports and started by talking about the moment Bears fans have been waiting for. It's almost here. I asked our panel of journalists about the high expectations for the Bears' new quarterback, Caleb Williams, wondering who's going to watch on Sunday. Here's Paris.
I'll be there.
You'll be there?
Oh, yeah.
Of course you will. Why am I surprised?
I'm a Bears season ticket holder. And Fox 32 is the home of the Bears. I have to say that. You know, it's... Before we get into what's going to happen on the field, what about the stadium? I mean, that's just kind of been sitting there. And Kevin Warren, the president of the Bears, says he wants to get shovels in the ground by 2025. And from everyone that I talk to around this, they're still hung on building that, you know, big dome stadium on the lakefront just south of Soldier Field. And lawmakers and the governor are like, no, we're not going to give you the $900 million, which will probably turn out to be more, that you're asking for in taxpayer money for this. And I think the Bears just think that they're going to be so good that the public momentum is gonna you know, change minds, and everyone's gonna be like, hey, governor, hey, lawmakers, hey, come on, let's step up to the plate. Let's get them a new stadium on the lakefront. I really don't think it's Kansas City, the Chiefs. They had a public referendum on publicly financing a new stadium. They turned it down. That's a Super Bowl champion team. So there's no appetite for public funding for these stadiums unless they go to an area that needs development. And there are folks that own the Michael Reese hospital, the old Michael Reese Hospital site just south of McCormick Place, that want to develop it there, that's Bronzeville. It's the south side. That area could use the development. And so that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. And then on the field, that's going to be interesting,
too. Yes, yeah, the game. So, Manny, did you say you were going to be watching?
Oh, 100%, yeah.
100%. I mean, do you think our expectations are a little too high for Caleb?
Yeah.
I'm extremely delusional. I'm extremely high.
I watched all the Hard Knocks. I wasn't totally sold going into it, but seeing the dynamics of the team.
I watched one of the Hard Knocks.
I mean, Caleb to Odunze all year, I think, is going to be...
For the next 15 years. Oh, you know what? I have PTSD as a Bears fan. And I've seen them draft quarterback after quarterback.
And we've heard you complain right here on the recap.
And only to just be like, what is going on? They either mismanage these quarterbacks and they never, you know, reach their potential, or the quarterbacks are just a bust. And they're the only team to not have a 4,000-yard passer, you know, ever. Like, their number one passer was Eric Kramer in 1995. He had like 3,800 yards. That was almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Their number one, that's before the NFL was even, that's before they relaxed all the rules on quarterbacks and receivers and it became a passing league and the Bears never took advantage. So, but no, Caleb Williams definitely seems different.
I'm optimistic. He's got me excited.
And not to evoke the Blackhawks, but it reminds me of Taves and Kane, right? When we talk about Caleb and Adunze. And if we can emulate that a little bit, I think we'll be
like, he's really good.
So. Well, we've never had a quarterback who can make half the throws Caleb can make. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've never really had a quarterback who can throw a 15-yard pass down the middle of the field to an open receiver.
He's a freak. So. He's amazing. But the question is the coaching staff capable of marshaling his talent and turning him into what he's potential to be?
We shall see.
Yeah.
All right, before we leave sports news, we've got to give a shout out to the Sky's Angel Reese. Mm. She set WNBA records, I don't know if y'all heard, for both rebounds and offensive rebounds. So defensive and offensive rebounds in one season. So kudos to Angel.
Her and Caitlin, they've turned the WNBA into just a spectacle. It's amazing.
It's fantastic. I want to switch gears with you, Manny, and talk about two grocery stores that reopened yesterday. So first up, Save-A-Lot in West Garfield Park. I mean, what was the scene like?
Yeah, Save-A-Lot in, as you mentioned, West Garfield Park opened its doors. Apparently, people were waiting 3 hours in line just to get a bag of free food.
Oh, okay.
Which really highlights sort of like the need and desire to have a full
function. So there was a giveaway.
Grocery. Exactly. Mm. And this marks the first opening out of the 6 stores, I believe. Yellow Banana, which is the parent company of Save-A-Lot, is set to open across the South and West Side. But it also sort of like highlights the long delay and sort of the problems that have faced Yellow Banana in its process of opening. I mean, they partnered with the city, I believe, for like a $13 million contract to sort of like have these, or tax incentives to have these stores open up. But, you know, they've also fallen on hard times, racking up millions of dollars of debt. And also, I believe they struggled to pay $800 in utility fees, the Sun-Times reported.
Oh, my goodness. As I said, this was a reopening. Why did they close in the first place?
All of the problems it faced, right? They had problems with just the food.
A rat infestation too? Was that right?
It was just a bunch of plethora of issues.
Wow.
That not just this Save-A-Lot faced. It was a lot of them.
Now, Paris, a very different type of store also reopened in the Gold Coast neighborhood. I'm talking about Foxtrot.
Yes. This not Save-A-Lot. I've never been to a Foxtrot market.
Me neither.
But, Mariano's is fine with me. But, you know, it's a very popular upscale grocery. It kind of shocked people when it closed in the Gold Coast and its other locations. It filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And so this is part of its reorganization now. You know, when you file for bankruptcy, you have to find a way to climb out of your debts by being leaner and meaner. So they're going to be a smaller company, but they're going to reopen the Gold Coast branch because it was doing good business. Mm-hmm. And so maybe they can succeed with fewer branches, fewer stores like the one in Gold Coast. And I'm kind of interested in the free coffee they're going to put out there and free pastries, I think, to get people back. I mean,
the wait will be longer than 3 hours, I'm sure.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness. Right. So do we know if Foxtrot plans to reopen its other shuttered stores?
I don't think we know that yet. I don't think they've determined that. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I think this is the only one that they've announced. But you know, like we said, they're going to be a smaller operation now.
I do wonder if this is sort of a way to get out of the Warren Act violations for sort of like abruptly firing people and sort of how do they navigate that?
Let's talk about that. Point. I mean, because this was back in April when they abruptly declared bankruptcy, shut down, you know, angering a lot of employees. I mean, have we heard anything about rehiring them?
I haven't heard anything.
No. Yeah.
And they just left the stores.
Yeah.
Like they didn't clean up or put anything.
Yeah. It's incredible. And bankruptcy is just kind of a way to get out of your obligations.
Yeah.
And so like they can come back and say, I mean, you know, well, they can pay their employees less, you know, because I think those are all questions.
Yeah. So Foxtrot hired back several former employees, including the store manager at the Gold Coast location. The chairman says that he plans to follow that strategy at the Old Town store and future reopenings.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, does it like lose its cachet, right? Like if it's like, oh, this is the cool, like, upscale thing. Like, nah, they're in bankruptcy.
Right.
Right. Okay. 61-year-old marathon swimmer Jim Dreyer. He took the plunge again on Labor Day, jumping into the water in Grand Haven, Michigan, hoping to make an 80-mile swim across Lake Michigan to Milwaukee. He made it 40 hours in the water before abandoning the swim. Oh, my goodness. So Dreyer actually did cross Lake Michigan back in 1998, starting in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, and finishing in Ludington, Michigan. But he's made three more attempts since 2023, and they've all been unsuccessful. So we'll see if he gives it yet another, wow, another shot. So you all might not be planning to swim across Lake Michigan, but with just over 2 weeks of summer left, I'm wondering what is on your summer bucket list.
I've had a pork butt in my freezer for much of the summer, and I wanna make the pork butt and have pulled pork sandwiches.
Yeah,
nice.
I'll be over.
Yeah,
I just want to get on a boat. I feel like I say that every year. I just want to get on Lake Michigan.
Yeah,
I got on a boat, and then when I got off, I learned that Trump had been shot.
Ooh.
Wow, it was a
you know what?
Dizzying day.
What do you want to do, Paris?
I want to do something that you can hardly do during the summer, and that's go to Grant Park and actually just walk around and play softball and walk your dog and stuff. Because I did a story last night on.
Give me the 10-second version.
Okay. All right. Well, the Tribune actually reported that Grant Park had been closed or all or partially for 70 days this summer because of NASCAR and Lollapalooza. The 10-second version is this public park, the front yard of Chicago, is closed for most of the summer because of these private events. And there's got to be a debate on what the right balance is here to keeping that park open to the public.
All right, Manny, maybe you just go out on the boat with me.
Yeah,
there we go.
Exactly.
Manny Ramos of Black Club Chicago, Paris Schutz of Fox 32, and Tom Shuba of the Sun Times. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Ash.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. If you enjoyed this conversation, make sure to tune in tomorrow and subscribe to the podcast so that you never miss another conversation. You can also check out our full archive of conversations at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.